So I'd like to introduce Niels Volkmann, who will give the first talk on EM Friedman.
Okay. Okay, so I'll be talking about how we can combine electron microscopy with atomic models. So the rationale behind that is obvious. With electron microscopy, we can get information on very complex systems, but it's usually fairly low resolution in comparison to what you can get with crystallography. So there are only very few cases where you can do build an atomic model directly from EM data. So what you'd like to do is to combine the two into something that tells you more than each of the single components can do. So you would have a low-resolution map, and you have atomic models of the components, and you try to get them somehow together to get information on, say, the interfaces between the components and how they are arranged within the larger complex. So, well, all we need to do is to stick in the atomic model into the EM density, you know, wiggle it and deform it so it fits, and then we're done, right? Well, not really. The problem, of course, is that we try to find very, very local positions of the atoms in a very low-resolution density. So it's easy to fit an atomic model into the density, especially if you deform it. But the hard part is to figure out how correct and how meaningful the model really is. Now, what that means, of course, is like other people who deal with three-dimensional data from 2D projections, we need proper tools for doing this. Yeah, I divided the talk in three parts. The first part is the obvious thing, is how can we stick the model into the density? And there are several ways of looking at that. One of the time-honored pastimes is to do manual docking, which means you have your reconstruction and anatomic model. You have a graphics program where you can manipulate the two, and you manipulate the atomic model until it looks nice and or sticks nice into the density, and there's nothing sticking out. And you consider that your atomic model in light of your EM data. So the obvious drawbacks of that are that you have a very high level of subjectivity with this. And there's also a very big benefit, which is an immediate visual feedback, which is important in many cases. And despite its drawbacks, you can get quite a bit of information just by using the manual docking approach. However, you'd like to have something that's a little bit more objective. So one way of doing that is with landmark-based docking, where you would use a reduced representation of your atomic model and the density as well. The reason for that, of course, is that that would be really fast in comparison to having to compare the complete density with the complete model. There's only moderate human intervention in this approach, but you will always lose some data because that's the nature of reducing your initial data set. Then another thing that's an issue is that it's relatively hard to assess what the real error in your docked model will be, and you will need a one-to-one correspondence of the map and the density. So density-based docking is another approach that's quite popular at the moment, and it doesn't need the one-to-one correspondence, so you can do something like a modular docking where you would have a large density and a relatively small component that you can dock into the density. There's fairly little human intervention once it's set up. Then the density data is fully explored because you don't reduce it in any way. It's independent of the contour level, but is relatively slow in comparison, especially in comparison with the landmark-based docking. So a derivative of this kind of approach is surface-based, where the density is modified to enhance surface features. So it has, in principle, all the properties of the standard density docking. But in addition, as if you have a very, very clean and well-defined map, it can enhance the sensitivity of the docking for components into larger maps. But also, if you have a noisy map, it can run into artifacts because the operation of enhancing the surface features is akin to running a high-pass filter on your density data, which can boost the high-frequency noise. So that can lead to problems, but can also be a good idea if you have a very nice, well-defined map. It's also, just like the density docking, relatively slow. Another approach, of course, is that you use some local refinement approaches to, so you put your model in without modifying it first by any of the methods I just mentioned, and then you start refining them to make them fit better into the density. So this can, of course, potentially account for local variation, and it can also use additional information such as stereochemistry or normal modes, and we will hear about that in the next talk as well. It reduces, however, the ratio between the observables and the parameters, so you always have to be aware that this can lead to overfitting if you introduce too many degrees of freedom into the system. So if you have a density and you have an atomic model, you can make it fit perfectly if you want to. You just have to release all the atoms and let them refine freely. But, of course, the model in the end will not be very meaningful. So the overfitting is always an issue to be aware of. This is just one example where we found that to be an issue. So that this is showing a test case where we had two conformations from a crystal structure. We calculated the low-resolution density from one conformation and then tried to fit in the other conformation by, in this case, defining three rigid bodies. And in that case, using a flexible fitting approach that lets the atoms refine relatively freely with some constraints of stereochemistry and positioning of the centers of masses. And as you can see, in many places it's comparable in performance, but in some places, like here, you get a significant displacement here. And the reason for that is that there were too many degrees of freedoms introduced into the system, so we get artifactual fits here. The last thing I wanted to mention is that, of course, you can use all types of filters when you do the docking, so in order to try to enhance certain features, you can do some masking, for example, where you use the footprint of your model in the search map, which can also enhance performance pretty nicely for relatively noise-free maps, but it's also some kind of high-pass filter, so you have to be also aware if you have very noisy maps, it might run into problems. Then there's a bunch of other filters that can be used, like weighting, for example, which can also improve performance in some cases. But you always have to pay a price, so because it's an additional operation, you slow down the process. Anyway, so just to summarize everything, we have a bunch of approaches for doing the docking, and some of them would use the comparison of atomic positions directly with the density. So this is kind of like comparing apples with oranges. Then you can convert an atomic model into density and then compare to the experimental density. So this is trying to take the apple, shape it into an orange as best as you can, and then compare the results together. The last thing you could do is to convert the atomic model And the density in something entirely different, like take an apple, make a banana out of it, take an orange, make a banana out of it, and then compare the bananas. And this is the three approaches that you could use, and I would concentrate on just this one, where we take the atomic model, try to generate a density from it that's as close as possible to how it would look like if you actually make an EM experiment, and then compare it to the experimental density. Now, once we decided what type of approach we picked in order to do the docking, we need to find a way to evaluate the quality of the fit, because now we only have it stuck into the density and it looks all very nice, but you know, how do we know it's better than the next solution that your neighbor comes up with? That leads to the concept of similarity measures, where you measure the fit between your atomic model and the density by some kind of number. And in statistical theory, the so-called maximum likelihood gives the best possible estimate of the fit in an unbiased way. You may be able to find a better fit, but that will be biased to some additional information that you stick in. If you have one set of information, the best you can do is maximum likelihood. And indeed, many of the more common similarity measures that are used in this context are some approximations of maximum likelihood. For example, this one, the correlation coefficient, relatively well known to most people. And that's a maximum likelihood measure if the noise is uniform Gaussian and the two functions, in this case A would be the atomic model or the density calculated from the atomic model, and E the experimental density. Then if those have an affine relationship, then this is maximum likelihood. So the cross-correlation itself, which is non-normalized but can be calculated in Fourier space relatively fast, is not a maximum likelihood measure for an affine relationship. It would require that E is equal to A in order to be maximum likelihood. So it's not scale independent is what that means. So how good is actually the approximation of having uniform Gaussian noise? Well, this is calculated from the background of two ice tomograms, essentially, and it shows that the distribution, which should be giving you a relatively good approximation of the error distribution, is indeed very close to Gaussian. So in this case, the correlation coefficient is a very good way to go. If you look at data that's from negatively stained or from plastic sections, there is a fair difference between the Gaussian and which is the red graphs, and this is the difference, and the experimental distribution. So in this case, you need to be aware that your correlation coefficient may not be the optimal way of comparing the densities. Another complication, of course, with this, with stain, negatively stained or any stain data, is that it's much harder to get your apple into the orange, because in ice you can calculate fairly accurately what the atomic model would do in terms of projection data. You can calculate that accurately. If you have stain present, it's a lot more complicated, and it's hard to get a good representation. Okay, wrong direction. Good, so now we decided what type of docking we want to use to stick the model in. And we have the similarity measure, so we can, you know, compare models between each other and say which one is better by the similarity measure. So what now? Are we done? Not quite. The problem is that we are dealing with real data, and that can be hazardous in terms of how to interpret the fit. So what we would want to know is not only which one is the best, we also want to know if we have a higher number for one of our test models, does that really mean it's better than another one that has a lower number? Because we have errors on our data, it might be that just by accident one is better than the other because just the error happens to be in a certain way. So we want to find some confidence intervals where we can say, okay, within this group, we cannot really distinguish which one is better, but we can say that some that has a much lower score is definitely not a candidate for the correct fit. So why do we need to do this? Well, one thing is that my favorite mathematical cookbook says that a really useful, truly useful docking procedure should not only give you the best and accurate parameters, it also should give you an error estimate on the parameters and statistical measure for goodness of fit, which would be, in this case, the confidence interval. So, and they claim that many practitioners don't do that really. They just go to item one, which is finding the best parameters they can, and then they deem the fit acceptable if it looks good. They call this chi by I. And unfortunately, most of the docking approaches available in our field are very much concentrating on this first point and kind of ignore the second ones a little bit. We've been working for the last couple of years on trying to address those two points, and what we came up with is a concept we call solution sets. And what we do is that we define a confidence level at which the solutions for the docking problem that we find are still equivalent fits in light of the data. And the reason why we need to do that I will demonstrate with this high-resolution image of cigar and how we would want to dock it into the low-resolution envelope of a cigar. So, you know, you pick your favorite docking approach and you rotate the cigar around this axis and you will get a graph like this. It's nicely defined. You can pick the maximum, which will be at 0 degrees here, and you say, okay, good, fine. So done with that. Now, if you scan along the other axis, you get a bit of a problem because it's really hard to distinguish which one is correct. And since you have noise, you will have like a little bit of wiggle in here. And indeed, you will get a maximum, which is around here. And that's almost as bad as it can get because zero is the correct solution and 180 degrees is just completely opposite. So that's no good. What you'd really like to have is something that tells you, okay, all solutions that have scores above this line I should consider as a possible solution. Everything below this line I can safely ignore. So in this case it doesn't help because it just tells you, okay, I cannot really decide which one is the correct orientation. In the other direction, it's better. You will find, okay, there's a bunch of solutions here that I need to consider, which contains the correct one, as we know. And there's also a possibility that it's 180 degrees around this axis. So that sounds bad, but it's in fact a good thing, because with this methodology, you can find degeneracies, and it will tell you where to look in order to solve your problem. So in this case, it will tell you, look, you cannot do anything with this problem if you don't introduce more information. So let's put a label. So if you do that and you get a comparison function for the label, then which is symbolized by this green graph, then you can actually pick the correct set of solutions here in this direction and also do the same thing in the other direction. So by this we can solve the problem, but rather than being stuck with the wrong solution that we would have, we have the correct solution because we introduced more information. Now, in practice, how would you do this? Fortunately, with the correlation coefficient, there's a huge literature that was developed in the early 1920s that gives you ideas on how you can get confidence intervals on correlation coefficients. And the key concept is called Fisher's Z-transform, which transforms the correlation distribution into something where you can define error, can define confidence levels in the standard way that you would do with other data sources. So what we can do is we can find the global maximum of the correlation coefficient for a docking problem, meaning you just scan the whole six-dimensional space and pick the best you can find. And then you choose a confidence level that's, you know, you can pick whatever you want to, but most people use either 99.5 or 99.9%. You'd find out what the standard deviation of your correlation coefficient is, and then you can do your confidence level. So you can test each correlation coefficient that you find and see whether it's significantly different from the maximum you found, and then if it's not significantly different, you cannot really say that it's worse than the best you found. So you have to consider that part of your set of solutions that's a reasonable solution to your docking problem. So this is how we define the solution sets. It's all solutions that are not significantly different from the maximum we can find. Now, how does that look like in practice? So this is showing just the correlation distribution around an axis, an angular scan. This is taken from Kanessin, fit into a 25 angstrom map. And this is showing the correlation coefficient here. So you see this, it's really hard to know where you need to put your line for the confidence level. So if you transform that using the Fisher Z transform, it transforms into something like this. So this is much, much better because it's much easier to pick things. So the meaning of this actually is that the confidence level is equal to 1 minus p, where this is the square root of p. So to demonstrate that in a practical case, so here would be our density. This is NCD, actually. So we have the density isolated from the EM map of NCD and the atomic model inside. So this is the best fit. What does that mean in terms of our graph here? So now we have the confidence level plotted here. If you have one single model, what that would mean is that you have basically zero confidence that this will be correct. Sounds weird, but just consider if you just move it by a thousandth of an angstrom, it's not the same anymore. And who can tell whether it's, you know, it's impossible to nail it down within that accuracy. So makes sense in a way. So if you now put another one that at least visually is not distinguishable from the first one, what that means is you move down on your graph here, so you allow more solutions to be part of the solution set. So everything that has scores above this line will be part of the solution set. Everything below will not be. So at this confidence level, which would be maybe like 10%, so you can be 10% sure, or however you want to interpret that, that one of those two is correct. So that's not good enough. So you put some more and some more until you actually get to your target confidence level, which in this case was 99.9%. And now you essentially know that with 99.9% probability, one of these models is as good as you can possibly do with this docking problem. What this also implies is if you want to be 100% sure that your solution is included, you need to consider the whole fitting space, right? Okay, so once we have those sets, what can we do with them? Well, they can be used to calculate all types of parameters that we are interested in. One of them is the coordinate error. This would be the second item on the shopping list for the numerical recipes. So you can actually get an error estimate with this. All you need to do is you take your whole solution set and you calculate something like the root mean square deviation in it, and that can give you an estimate on how well-defined the fit is. So in other words, if you have the correspondence between density and atomic model is really good, you will get a very tight solution set with a low root mean square deviation. If it's very loose, you will get a much larger set with a much higher root mean square deviation. So this is another example how we can use it. We can actually look at conformational variation with that, because if you have various conformations that can fit the map, then you will get a larger spread, a higher root mean square deviation within your solution set, and you can analyze that. In this case, which is taken from an actomyosin density and then doing modular fits with what's called the motor domain here, which is the front bit, and the light chain domain, which is the back bit, and we found that there's a lot more variation in the light chain domain than in the motor domain. So this zero line is the zero line here, and then the distance is running this way, showing that the root mean square deviation is increasing with the distance from the motor domain, light chain domain interface. And it's also direction dependent, so the dark line is actually perpendicular to the screen, to the screen plane, whereas this is within the screen plane. So we can do all these types of analysis and look on at how the variability looks like. In this particular case, we were able to get some independent information on the variability, which is a helical type of variance mapping, and that showed peaks exactly in the same place where we find the high root mean square deviation. So this is working well. So another thing we can do is to define something we call interaction probabilities. So rather than having to rely on our best fit and, you know, measure distances between the surfaces, we can just say, okay, we consider all fits that are within our solution sets, and since one of them should be the right one, if for all of them the residue is an interaction distance, then we have a high chance that that's a real thing. If it's only for half of them, then the probability of being a true interaction is lower. So this is an example of fimbrin here, an actin-binding protein bound to an actin filament, and this is just the best fit showing in two directions. And this is the interaction probability mapped onto the molecule. So red is very high interaction probability, and blue is none at all. So you can see that you get a nice pattern here where you have very high probability in some places and then lower probabilities in others. So what you can do with this, of course, is you can give that back to your collaborators and say, look, if you want to mutate some residues, you actually have a ranked list now, because the red ones are more likely to be part of the interactions than, say, the green ones. The other thing you can do with this, if you see the red peak here, this is actually a significant difference between the atomic model and the density, the experimental density in the EM, and this can also be calculated using the solution set, whether it's significant or not. And in this case, this gives us the location of a third domain that was present in the EM construct, but we don't have a crystal structure for. So that gives us also very valuable information for the function in this case. So then I'd like to go back to the degeneracies. I was talking about that earlier in the cigar context, and give an example, which is, again, fimbrin. the one I demonstrated the interaction probabilities with. So fimbrin is an interesting molecule because it has two component homology domains, which means these two halves are homologous, and at low resolution what happens is that it expresses itself as pseudosymmetry. So the axes that I put here are actually the symmetry axis for the pseudosymmetry. So if you take, for example, the alpha axis and you calculate your correlation around this axis and z-transform it, then you get something like this. You get two peaks that are 180 degrees apart, and both of them are above our confidence line here, so you have to consider this one as a kind of like a partitioned solution set where you have this solution and this solution present.
Oh.
Okay, I guess I cancel this. Okay, so that's one way of looking at it. Another way of looking at it is with cluster analysis. So what you do is you take all your solutions that have a high correlation coefficient. So the correlation coefficient, the magnitude is going downwards here on this plot, bar plot down here, and the gray area is the one that is below the confidence cutoff, and everything in the white range is above the cutoff, and this is essentially the distance between, like the root mean square deviation between each and every model that we found in our scan. So you can see that in this case we get three clusters that are that have contributors that are part of the solution set. So the solution set is partitioned into three distinct clusters that have more than 15 angstrom root mean square deviation between them. There's a fourth one here, but this doesn't have any members of the solution set. So, and again, this is done for the fimbrin case. What that this just shows the four pseudosymmetric solutions that you would find. So I was talking earlier about the surface-based docking. The way to do that is called Laplacian correlation. And you can do the same type of analysis. So in this case, you actually find only one cluster that is significant. So that looks good in principle, but we shall see what that means. So this is showing the fits of the fimbrin atomic model into the density, the XYZ clusters from the previous slide. And you can see all of them look fairly reasonable in terms of visual fit. And for the Laplacian, the first solution, the only one that had had members in the solution set, is more or less equivalent to the X, whereas this is totally off, and this would be equivalent to Y. So the fimbrin case has a degeneracy in this one axis particularly where you cannot nail it down. So what we actually did is to do something similar to the label, putting a label on the cigar. We used all available biochemical and biophysical information on the interface and mapped that on our solutions. And what we found is that actually this solution is the correct one. So what that means is with the density correlation, we first picked up that there are degeneracies. We did pick up the correct solution, whereas with the Laplacian filter, if we would have believed it, we would have been stuck with a wrong solution, which is artifactual, also actually for the density correlation alone. So in this case, it wouldn't have been a good idea to rely on the Laplacian filter. Reason for that, the map is really quite noisy, and it's also not a one-to-one correspondence, which is also sometimes a problem. Okay, so the last thing I'm going to do is to go quickly through one application example. This is helical reconstruction of actin bound to smooth muscle myosin. The map is about between 20 and 25 angstrom resolution. So what we need to do is first to isolate the myosin contribution from the complete reconstruction, then define our modules, how we want to dock it, then dock the largest module, subtract the contribution of the dock module, and go back to step 3 until there's no module left. Okay, this is how the reconstruction looks like. You have actin in the center and the myosin coming off on the sides. So fortunately, we also had a map of actin that is not decorated with myosin, so we can generate a difference map. So this is now just the myosin contribution in the helix. In the center, the actin is gone. And now we can isolate a single unit of this, which looks like that, in relation to the naked actin, something like this. And now we can start doing our docking experiment. So the first thing we do is we make it transparent, and then we take the crystal structures of this construct that are available in the database and dock them. So first case doesn't quite fit well. Second case doesn't quite fit that well either. And this fits a little bit better, but still not so good. You can see it's, interestingly, it's totally dominated by the white domain, which is the motor domain I was mentioning earlier. And this arm is sticking out. So by comparing the crystal structures, we can find out that there are actually three modules that kind of move independently, which is the motor domain itself, the bluish and red one together is the light chain domain, and the orangey one here is called the converter. I should have this. There we are, yeah. Which is kind of like mediating between the two domains and steering the movement of the lever arm. So this is our modules. We have our modules defined. Now we can take the whole thing apart and start docking the largest domain first. So now this is really nice. There's nothing sticking out here. And we can just subtract the contribution from the experimental map, and then we dock the second largest domain into this. Remember, this is this can be fit in many different conformations, as you can see here now quite nicely. You can, you know, you have enough room to move it up and down here. This is just showing the best fit. And yeah, then we can get rid of this one and dock the tiny one. Then we put it all back together, and voila, everything fits quite nicely. And we actually have now an atomic model of myosin bound to actin. So now you've done this, you can do the same thing, obviously, with a different condition, which is this one. So the first one was without nucleotide. Myosin, actomyosin interactions are driven by ATP hydrolysis. And this is with ADP in the nucleotide binding pocket. And you can see that there is a difference in the position of this lever arm. That's obvious, and people knew that already. Tim?
Did you say it, or are you going to say whether you enforced connectivity?
Say that again?
Did you enforce connectivity?
For the light chain domain, I didn't. For the converter, I did. Converter is too small. If you let it refine freely, it just goes everywhere. But again, we could pick that up with a solution set concept, which just tells us, okay, we cannot fix it if we don't say that the connectivity has to be there. Yeah?
Well, with this method, what about bone lengths and possible spherical clashes?
That's we use that usually as quality criterion.
But don't you do a minimization?
We do that at the end, yes. But before we do that, we check whether the distance is reasonable.
Okay.
In this case, we didn't have to enforce anything except for the converter. And then afterwards, there were like minor, obviously, where you break the chain, you need to reconnect it, and we did some minimization for doing that. But all of that was perfectly reasonable, no big deal. Anyway, so you have these two, and remember, it's sets now. So you have one set and another set, and you can compare those and do t-tests between movements and anything you like. So you can actually build something like this, which is a compilation of all the movements that happen and that are significant between the two states. So one of these things, of course, is the movement of the lever arm. We knew that already, because that's visible instantly as soon as you have the maps done. But what came as like a little bit of a surprise is that the motor domain is also moving, contributing to that movement. And another thing that's visible is that this little white hook here is actually twisting and turning. And that was significant in our analysis, but we didn't really fully believe it. But independently later on with spectroscopy experiments, they found exactly the same thing. So that's a good thing. I tried to run this one more time so you can see the movements I was just talking about. Okay. Good. So watch the motor domain. That's, you know, you can see that it moves. It's easier to see in the other direction. So now you see it move. It's relatively small, but it's significant. And you can also see the twisting of this little hook thing, which is going this way. So again, the only way of actually being able to tell these things is by doing the statistical analysis between the two sets, because the resolution of the maps alone is not good enough to actually get this unique fit that would be, you know, if you have atomic resolution densities, you can obviously fit the two molecules, and you can be reasonably sure there's a difference between them. If you would do that just with that low resolution density, you couldn't. The only way of telling it is using the statistical analysis. And that's where I'd like to end. I just want to acknowledge my lab and my collaborators that gave data for this analysis. And I'd be happy to answer any questions that remain. Michelle?
So, I was wondering, when you break down your myosin into the
automated algorithm, or do you just... Yes, no, we used, since we had, for myosin, there's like 20 plus crystal structures available now. So just by comparing the crystal structures, you can get a very accurate idea where the hinges and chair movements and all of that sit, and there are programs available for calculating that. And that's what we use in order to define the modules. This is just extrapolated. It's with enforcement of stereochemistry, but there's no energetics going in there. It's not molecular dynamics.
Yes. It appeared to me that when you fit correct structure into correct map, you still obtain these solutions. So what is, when you fit correct this corresponding map, you could still generate this set of solutions.
Yes. Well, it's the reason why you would do that in a real case is because you have errors attached to your data. There's no way around it. So whatever you do, you always have you know, more than one possibility to fit it in, because you know, even with atomic models, you have B factors attached, which is essentially smearing out the solution over space, which is the same thing. Yes, but I don't understand what the problem would be.
The problem is that somebody could treat this method into thinking that there are many possibilities, while the fact is that it won't.
Yeah,
if my
math
is correct and has no errors, according to this approach, I would still obtain a large number of possibilities.
No, but the point is that what that would... what happened with this is that your standard deviation of the correlation coefficient would be zero. So in fact, you would only get one single solution. Yes, yes, yes.
Because two pieces always will correlate.
Say again?
Two pieces will always correlate as long as your correlation coefficient, but then just collect the fact that they occupy the same space.
No, but what you do is, maybe I should have explained that better. When I say the distribution of the correlation coefficient, I don't mean the distribution you get when you fit one model into the map. What I mean is a distribution that you would get for a certain orientation when you take lots of maps. So you would do, what we usually do is to take either two completely independent maps or as many as we can lay our hands on. For the Myosin study, we had 8 different maps that we had from different experiments. And then we compile the statistics of the correlation coefficient for one position using all those maps. So that's kind of like the concept. Now, if you have totally correct maps, and you take one position, and you put one correct map, and the next correct map, and the next correct map, then you get a standard deviation of zero. So what that means is that your solution set, in fact, will be just one single solution. Does that make sense?
Yes, I think what I want to ask you is correlated to what Paolo said. Don't you think you explore too much possible solution by examining separate segments of all the protein? And don't you think an absolute best coefficient of correlation is maybe not the best solution if you take into account the contributions of the other modules?
No, I don't think so. I think it's a very sensible approach to break it up into modules and to look at the single modules. As a matter of fact, the sensitivity gets better the more local you get.
And then what do you think about the real space refinement approach, which takes in account that sort of segmentation, but taking on account also the rest of the molecule?
I think it's a very good idea to do real space refinement in many cases, but you will have to be careful about how many degrees of freedom you put in and how you... the overfitting is always a problem with that. And the way that we usually approach that is... let me see, I may have this just right here. Yeah. So this is a quick example how we approach that without actually having to do the real space refinement. So this is the fit of the complete Myosin molecule that I showed into the map. And if we subtract the contribution of the Myosin fitted atomic model from the map, we get something like this. We get a distribution of peaks here, and all of these have meanings. That one of those is particularly interesting, which is the peak that sits right in this cleft here, and it's reproducible over many many maps and many different Myosin isoforms. And what this tells us is that there's a significant difference between the atomic model and the map. There's too much density in the EM map in comparison to the model. And while we don't feel confident to actually model what's going on, we can say that there must be a movement of one or both of these domains to close this cleft, because otherwise this peak couldn't exist. So now one way, if you want to do the real space refinement, would be to use this kind of information to guide your real space refinement. So you can say, okay, I can see that I'm allowed to use these two modules to see what I can do in order to fit this better, but I'm not allowed to define any modules in this bit, for example.
Mentioned before that it helps to have biochemical or physical evidence
It depends on what type of problem you're looking at. You can labels, for example, is one good thing to use. If you have a gold label attached somewhere, that's a very good constraint. You know, very confident. Yeah, this is something that we use sometimes. And fret distances you can use. And for the Fimbren case, we actually used some mutagenesis data and peptide binding data and that kind of thing. We just defined some kind of function where we said, okay, if the mutation does something to the binding, then it has a certain probability to be in the interface. So we mapped all of that on the whole surface and the whole molecule and used that as an additional scoring function. But the only way we actually use that is since our primary source of information in this is the density, so we usually use that information only to pick which one of the clusters that we get is the correct one. Then we use that for the rest of the analysis.
A stupid question here. You mentioned the degrees of freedom, the importance of the degrees of freedom that you allow. So how many degrees of freedom did you have in your myosin model? Did you just...
Yes. No, just rigid bodies. So for each of the bodies, it's 6 degrees of freedom. And that's it. And it's run independently, so it's not even strictly additional.
All right, I'm going to try to ask the students can ask the questions right now, because we are running out of time. So there's one other question, and I think we should move.
Do you have some software available for trying to do this?
Yes. Yeah, you should contact me, and then we can figure something out. It's still very experimental and stuff, so. But it's available in principle, yes.
So will you be around during the break if people have additional questions?
Yes, I can. Yeah, I can do that.
Great. Okay, well, thank you very much.
Sure.
So the heat looks like it's been fixed.